talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the remarkable contribution to Irish heritage of Lily and Elizabeth Yates, the Yates sisters, and we'll be debating their impact on the arts in Ireland. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. In tonight's show, we're looking at the remarkable lives of Lily and Elizabeth Yates, two women whose talents and vision played a pivotal role in the Irish arts and crafts movement and the cultural revival of the early 20th century. Lily and Elizabeth Yates, often overshadowed by their more famous brother W.B. Yates, were trailblazers in their own right. Elizabeth, known for her pioneering work with the Dunemer Press and later the Kula Press, brought Irish literature and art to the international stage. Lily, who was born Susan, was a gifted embroiderer and infused traditional crafts with a new vitality, significantly influencing Irish visual culture. Next Saturday, the 13th of July, the annual Yates Sisters Symposium will take place at Taney Parish Centre in Dundrum in Dublin from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. and its website is theyatessisters.com. And there's also a significant new exhibition taking place on the work of the Yates sisters in Trinity's Old Library. And so in tonight's show, we want to celebrate the Yates sisters' contributions to Irish heritage and their lasting impact on the arts. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Roisin Kennedy is assistant professor in the School of Art History and Cultural Policy at UCD and is an expert on the critical reception of modern art in Ireland and the position of women as artists and subjects in modern art. And she's the former Yates curator at the National Gallery of Ireland. Dr. Quailín Ní Bhacán is associate professor in communications at the University of Limerick and is an expert in Irish cultural history as well as women writers and publishing and business history. Susan O'Keefe is director of Yates Society Sligo and is an award-winning journalist, TV producer and director, commentator and opinion writer, as well as a former senator. Dr. Billy Shortle is research fellow at TRIARC in the Department of the History of Art and Architecture at Trinity College Dublin. Well, you are all very welcome. And Billy, I might start with you. Let's just clarify the names of the women, because you have Susan Yates, who went by Lily, and then you have her sister Elizabeth, who was sometimes known as Lolly. And I see them sometimes described as Susan and Elizabeth Yates. I see them sometimes described as Lily and Elizabeth, and sometimes as Lily and Lolly. What did they call themselves, and how should we refer to them?
Lily, who was christened Susan Mary Yates after her mother, who was also Susan. So avoid confusion, she was always called Lily. And throughout her life, she used the name Lily, and she signed all legal documents that you can see in the archives. She signed everything as Lily and was never known really as anything else. Elizabeth was christened, obviously, Elizabeth. And she had a pet name within the family, particularly early on in her life, called Lolly. And she would use this to sign birthday cards and occasional correspondence, but almost all the time she used the name Elizabeth. And later on in her career, she was writing to one of the artists who designed prints for Kula Press. And she said she really found her name comic and she didn't like people using Lolly, that her name was Elizabeth. Throughout her life, she signed every document Elizabeth and she always referred to herself as Elizabeth. So their names are Lily and Elizabeth. And sometimes I contrast that to William Butler Yeats, who throughout his life was known as Willie. And now we just refer to him as William all the time because it gives him more gravitas. Whereas Lily and Lolly, it's a very poetic pairing, but it belies their individual talents and their individualities. And Elizabeth, who ran a world-renowned arts and crafts private press, and Elizabeth, who was an embroideress whose work went all over the world.
Very good. Now, Susan, talk to me about the early lives of the sisters, because they were the younger sisters of William Butler Yeats. They were the sisters of Jack B. Yeats. So it's an artistic family. It's a poetical family. Talk to me about what it was like for them growing up.
It was an extraordinarily talented family. And when you think here we are in the 21st century, continuing to celebrate all the surviving members of the Yeats family, Of course, there were two other children, Robert, who died at the age of three, and Jane Grace, who died at 9 months. And that was a very difficult thing for Susan, their mother, at a time when children died. There was little support or little recognition of the trauma that that might have caused, not just a mother, but the other siblings and a wider family. And Susan Pollockson had married John Yates rather swiftly, and their two eldest children, William and Susan, as Lily, as Billy has adequately described, they were the first two, and they were a year apart, and they were quite close, and they were still part of the era of that family when everything seemed still to be intact, when their father John was still looking like he was going to pursue his career at the bar as a very, probably a very distinguished lawyer, and when Susan had two children and could still see the prospect for optimism. But of course, within another year, John had made clear that he was no longer going to be a barrister, and he wanted to be an artist, and he decided to use some of his own money to train to be an artist. And at that point, if you like, Susan Pollockson's life sort of fell over a cliff, because now she had two small children, discovered in 1868 that she was pregnant again, and her husband was now had taken his eye off the prize, which was a very glittering prize, would have been the comfortable house in Dublin, the reputation that went with marrying, you know, a very fine, elegant, loquacious man who would have done very well for himself, educated at Trinity College. And all of a sudden, she was facing, you know, into a life with a man who wanted to be a painter but wasn't established, already had two tiny children, and then found herself pregnant with Elizabeth. And there's a division almost between the two earlier children and Elizabeth, and then later Jack, whom she was very fond of. And Elizabeth particularly fell into that darker place in Susan's life, in her mind, and how that changed the family dynamic entirely. So Susan fell, if you like, on the sunny side and Elizabeth on the darker side. They were always together, as it happened, because, of course, they were the two sisters in the centre of the family, and they were always seen as the girls, and, of course, were not at all educated in the same way as particularly William was, with his father, if you like, investing masses of energy in what he perceived a genius son. And Jack, their younger brother, being sent back to Sligo to live with his grandparents because they were too poor to feed all the children, and him having rather a jolly time wandering around Sligo with his sketchbooks and kind of having a very carefree young existence with grandparents who didn't really mind what he did. After all, they had reared 12 children of their own. They weren't going to be particularly bothered with young Jack. So the sisters kind of fell into that difficult space, which, of course, they've retained up until relatively recently as the sisters that were really the hidden part of the family. And so that, as you can imagine, had a profound effect then on the way they grew up together and how they interacted both with each other as sisters and with their brothers, and then obviously also with their parents. So it was a very interesting way in which the family dynamic changed in a heartbeat almost.
And Susan, they did spend a considerable period in England, in London, before returning, I think, in 1902. So how formative was that period?
Yes, you're right. They did spend, their father, John, ever the sort of vague optimist, trying to find more work as a portrait painter, moving from London, moving back to Dublin, moving back to London, moving house, always trying to kind of beat the landlord because he would always be struggling to pay the rent. And the children kind of being trailed along with this, and the two sisters never really having a proper formal education. He was very insistent, John Yates, that his son William would go to school, but the sisters not so. And obviously, from reading any of the books written about the sisters, it is clear that Elizabeth was particularly bright and terribly able and asked a lot of questions and wanted to share the limelight that her older brother clearly had. But she could never curry favour with her father. It didn't matter which way she went at it. He kind of always, he would banish her to her room if she was, as he described, too noisy. When she started painting, when they were small children and they went away on a holiday to Devon or Cornwall, I can't remember which, and she was painting watercolours, they were apparently actually really quite good, but she never got any support. And then when her first writing, she published a short story when she was relatively, in her late teens, Again, John, the father, read it, but never really praised her in the manner he would have done had it been Willie's short story. And so she was always trying to get a foothold, and was always envious of the fact that Susan, her sister, got on much better with her parents, was more calm and was more inclined to, you know, go with the flow. And Susan's had been a very difficult birth. She was 2 months premature, or nearly three. And at that point in 1866, she was lucky to have survived at all. And her health was always a bit precarious. So she was the more fragile of the two, literally, and Elizabeth the more robust. And yet they found themselves together and then together in business. But the thing they did share was their great talent. They both were exceptionally talented. Susan's capacity to grasp intricate needlework was very fine. You know, she had the patience, she had the eye, she knew what she was doing. And Elizabeth, of course, you know, getting a small amount of training in watercolours, going out to teach Frebel, teaching to young children, you know, getting her own book published with her friends. Like, she was a powerhouse of a woman, but always the one standing sort of to the side of the other three, because Jack, of course, was the handsome golden boy, the white-haired boy, the one everyone loved. He was younger. He was a bit funny. He was a bit laid back. He didn't have the kind of darkness of the others. And so Elizabeth was the one with great talent, but found it very difficult to fit. So when they came to Dublin and started working together, they carried that baggage with them. But remember, they had been crucial in London to going out and finding work and helping William particularly to keep going. William had no income really as an establishing poet. For God's sake, where were they going to earn money? Whereas Elizabeth and Susan earned a wage, went out to work and brought home money to the house, which John could rarely do, and actually helped to make it a calmer household because they had some money finally. So they were very strong women before they ever opened Dunemer and subsequently Coola. You know, that's often forgotten or not seen in the way that they physically helped. And it wasn't just about their talent. It was about their business head. The Pollockson business head is what they all had, ultimately, the four of them.
And Susan, I'm intrigued by your description of the darkness that was there, especially in Elizabeth. How did that manifest itself?
Well, you can imagine if Elizabeth's being banished by her father or subsequently being ignored, and their mother, who had grappled and struggled terribly, really terribly, with four young children. She hadn't learned to sew. She hadn't learned to cook. She clearly had never changed a nappy. My God, for, you know, imagine that, a middle class woman changing nappies. And so, you know, her life was fraught. And so she brought a fraught air to the house and subsequently had several strokes and really withdrew from the house. There was a kind of an oppression there, not her fault or her doing in that sense. And because Elizabeth was tangled up in her mother's rejection of her, almost, and trying then to gain her father's approval and Willie's approval, neither of whom ever really gave her that, not clearly, not in the way that would have brought her in. It was always that kind of fraught, I think, is probably the best word. And Elizabeth always struggling with that, and then struggling ultimately with her sister, with whom, of course, they ended up sharing their working lives together. And in practice, they would have been far better if they'd been quite apart. They would have been happier, I think. But life served that for them, and they stuck to it, and to their collective credit, stuck at it and made Coola Press be a real beacon for the arts and crafts in Ireland, and be something where they lived up to their own truth, which was, they said, they wanted to make things that were beautiful. And that was a great thing. This was no Woolworths approach, you know, pile them high and sell them cheap. This was, let's make beautiful things and let's share them with people. And they did that even when they were struggling themselves nearly to eat. They would always put their work into making those books and those tapestries and those posters and those cards be as beautiful as they could.
Roisin, it's fascinating that when we talk about the literary revival and we talk about the cultural revival, it's interesting that as part of that cultural revival story, we don't really focus as much on the arts and crafts dimension. And so they tend to not get as much attention as they deserve.
I think that's true. I think that's changing. I mean, I think since the 1990s with Paul Larmer and Nicola Gordon-Bow, you know, have published extensively on the arts and crafts movement and the different facets of it. And now we know an awful lot more about Dunemer, and of course Billy's work, and the current project in Trinity is very important in that respect. But yeah, generally, I think in Ireland, the visual arts always come second to literature. And in, you know, the mainstream publications on the cultural revival, it is true that the arts and crafts tend to be sort of sidelined. But I think the relationship between the arts and crafts and the cultural revival was quite complex, in that the origins of the arts and crafts really go back to sort of aristocratic, very Anglo-Irish interventions into home industries in the 1880s and 1890s. And the arts and crafts movement, I think, carry that legacy into the post-independence period, which may be one reason why it was sort of relegated to the sidelines for so many decades.
And it's very interesting when you look at the relationship between the two sisters and the rest of the family, and the way they do collaborate then with Dunemer and with the Cooler Press and so on, that it seems very, despite whatever arguments they might have or fallings out, there is a tightness and a closeness there.
Yeah, definitely. There was a very close sense of collaboration, particularly, well, through Dunemer, Jack Yates and his wife Cotty produced designs, for example, for the banners in Loughrea Cathedral that Dunemer were involved in very early on, which was a very, very important arts and crafts project, a cathedral that everything in it was made by Irish craftsmen and women. So that was very important. And in fact, it's arguably could be said that Jack Yates was really had to move back to Ireland in 1910 because of his very close involvement with the Cooler publishing of A Broadside, which these were sort of monthly publication that he really was in charge of editorially, and he produced illustrations for many years from about 1908 up until 1915. And so he was very involved producing images for prints and Christmas cards right up until the mid-1920s, when he really withdrew from the project because he wanted, I think, to focus more on his writing and on his painting, his oil painting. His fine art career in that sense. But definitely they were very close. They, Cotty and Jack visited the sisters very regularly, and they used to invite the workers from Cooler out to their house in Greystones. And I think there was that sense of, it being a family business, they're needing each other's support. Jack and Cotty would have worked for very little money to produce material for Dunemer and for Cooler. And I think perhaps also the others may have something to say on this, but I think maybe they were held together by John Butler Yeats, who had vanished off to New York in around 1908. He'd gone over with Lily. They were selling Dunemer. She was selling Dunemer stuff in New York at a fair in that year. And he refused to come home. And he remained in New York on his own till 1922, causing massive worries for all the four siblings. And I sort of wonder if at some level that kind of kept them together, because it was a few years after, you know, just 2 or 3 years after his death, that Jack seemed to assert an independence, really, from particularly Elizabeth's projects.
And Quailene, it's fascinating when you look at the communications infrastructure that was there at the time, because that was contributing to the success of the revival as well.
That's right, Patrick. You know, the Dunemer volumes, almost from the moment they launched, were, you know, incredibly successful. They circulated internationally, they were reviewed widely, and they generated extraordinary interest. And in a sense, I suppose, shows, I mean, it was interesting, Roisin referred to the Yeatses as kind of having a family business, but the kind of acumen that was there and the planning that was there to ensure that these books would reach their intended audience. And you have to think, when, again, you know, listening to what the others have already outlined, you know, that all three women were based in London in the 1890s. And in a sense, you know, they were very much a product of the intellectual life that was there and the arts and crafts movement. But in a sense, the logic of the revival necessitated that this literature would emanate and this culture would emanate from Ireland itself. And so, I mean, this kind of raised a lot of problems and challenges for them, because the literary market was thriving in Britain at this time, with commercial publishers and arts and crafts private presses. You know, there was a really vibrant book trade there. But Ireland had, you know, had a comparatively small and poor reading public, incapable of supporting its homegrown authors or publishers. So, you know, if these provincial publishers in Ireland, you know, they couldn't compete with the terms, the royalties and the commercial networks offered in London. So in a sense, you know, the logic of the revival necessitated the development of an infrastructure and an audience that was separate from that was in London. So when the Dunemer published its first volume, you know, they had to kind of ensure, you know, they couldn't have a commercial ordinary edition coming from Dublin because, you know, the Dublin publishers just couldn't meet their needs. So it was a very interesting dual edition strategy that they had. So they would have this subscription edition, a private subscription, fine art, fine printing edition that would reach, in the case of in The Seven Woods, the first volume in 1903, that would reach 300 subscribers. And these subscribers are really interesting in and of itself. So the subscription list provides this kind of record of a really impressive and influential coterie that was international in its reach. For the most part, you know, the subscribers were based in Ireland and Britain and America. But, you know, there was also, you know, South Africa, Egypt, France, you know, so it was a very international subscription network. And the network itself kind of reveals the ecosystem that was going to support the project. So what you have, I suppose, is this beautiful edition produced in Dublin, you know, and the prospectuses kind of talk about this, that it was made by Irish hands using Irish handmade paper, Irish linen casing. And, you know, as a review said afterwards, that the body of the thing has kinship with its soul, that it would both be, I suppose, a manifestation, but also a dissemination tool of the revival itself, that the object itself would be beautiful. They would have this agentic power. So that if you picked up the book in New York or Minnesota, that you know, you would have a sense that this was of Ireland and that this was part of this revival. And in a way, I think then, you know, that it also moved. And again, another newspaper report of the time says, you know, and this is a British paper, the Daily News, says Dublin has succeeded in becoming the centre of this movement. So it really was this key moment of decentering away from the imperial metropolitan centre back to Ireland. And it still allowed this dual edition strategy, the subscription volume, still allowed authors to co-publish, to publish at the same time, a commercial ordinary edition that would reach an international audience. And again, the Yeats correspondence is very interesting on this. And, you know, they had secured Elizabeth in her opening business notes. She lists three advisors. Again, I think really significant. There's A.P. Watt for sales and rights. He's very interesting. He's recognised as the oldest literary agent in the world. You know, he basically developed the kind of professional business. And he would have kind of, you know, developed contracts that kind of protected different interests and managed, say, bundles of rights sales. He managed copyright. The second advisor was Emery Walker, you know, who worked very closely with William Morris and Kellam Scott. And later in the Dove's Press, and, you know, again, a really important figure in the international arts and crafts movement. And then W.B. Yeats, of course, is the literary agent. But what you see in the correspondence around this time is that they were very concerned with protecting the copyright of authors. So on the same day that they would produce the special subscription edition, it would be published on the same day and registered in America or Britain or wherever as well.
So there was a strong business operation as well, that they weren't going to get outmaneuvered or caught out by anything there. But Quailene, I'd love to know, what was really the point of the publishing press? Was it to bring to publication works that might not have got published anyway? Or was it to produce particularly elegant and beautiful editions of the books? So Yeats's In the Seven Woods, that was published in 1903, we've talked about how beautiful that was, and it was cased in full Irish linen and so on in the special edition, but that presumably would have got a publisher anyway. So was it to try and bring works by lesser known writers and authors to the public consciousness, or was it to do it in a way that was an artistic form in the way it was published as well?
Yeah, I think that really gets to the heart of it, because more the latter. So the authors that are published by Dunemer, you know, they're well known. They're kind of luminaries of the revival. You've Lady Gregory, you've George Russell, you've Douglas Hyde, you've Catherine Tynan, and you've Yeats himself. And these, they would have been published anyway. But what, again, I think if we think about these subscriptions, beautiful subscription editions, is they're creating aura and prestige for the texts themselves. You know, they're not kind of ordinary commercial editions being, you know, published in London along with everything else that's been published in London. These are kind of, you know, there's an idea that the book itself, and Yeats, both Elizabeth and William Butler Yeats, had this sense that the book quality had a kind of, could have a kind of alchemy, that it would transform the text itself into something worth owning, that it would kind of give a sense of its prestige, its importance as a kind of, as an artifact and as an literary and cultural intervention. So in that sense, that, you know, to publish the book in Ireland, to have it as, and, you know, and to get the book into the right hand. So the subscription, as I say, the subscription list, an initial subscription list is really impressive in terms of who they have there. And I suppose one, again, very significant thing is, you know, of course you have people like, you know, I mean, you have a lot of booksellers and bibliophiles in the list. I mean, you know, Elkin Matthews, Hodges and Figgis, you know, there's a lot of names there that we would recognize, Little Brown and company. But we also have, you know, a lot of academics. We have, you know, we have a lot of international arts and crafts people all on that list. And in a way, by having these influencers, I suppose to use a contemporary term, who would review the book, who would circulate, who would discuss the book and the text, that it allowed the book to have a currency in, if we call it, the literary marketplace.
Well, tonight we are talking about the Yeats sisters, Lily and Elizabeth. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll find out about the tensions at the press and where it all went wrong. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history. Tonight we are talking about the Yeats sisters. The annual Yeats Sisters Symposium is taking place this Saturday at Taney Parish Centre in Dundrum in Dublin from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. If you want to find out further information, just go to their website, theyeatssisters.com. My panel of experts have rejoined me, Dr. Roisin Kennedy of UCD, Dr. Quailín Ní Bhacán of the University of Limerick, Susan O'Keefe, Director of Yeats Society Sligo, and Dr. Billy Shortle of Trinity College Dublin. Billy, can we talk about Evelyn Gleeson, the designer who's crucially involved, and then the tensions in the Dúnemer press? Because I was reading about an interview that Lily and Elizabeth gave to the magazine House Beautiful, and they didn't mention Evelyn at all. And Evelyn's teacher, her design teacher in London, compared it to Hamlet without the prince. And it seems that the sisters thought that she was, that Evelyn was arrogant. There was tensions. They thought she was bad-tempered. They seemed to have snubbed her. There also seems to have been tensions with the brother W.B. Yeats as their kind of literary advisor and agent. And there do seem to have been those tensions right at the start of it.
Well, that's correct. It was established in 1902 and the first book was published in 1903. And the first internal split within Dúnemer happened in 1904. So it's almost like it was the first item on the agenda was the split. But I think probably some of that difficulty stems from the fact that the Yeats brought no money to the enterprise. They brought contacts and they bought craft skills, and Evelyn Gleeson provided the finance. And whatever else we say about the beautiful productions and the other motives they had, and we have to remember these were sort of women enterprise, they implied only women, but they also needed to make money. And I think Evelyn Gleeson was under pressure to repay loans and finances. So I think the finances had a part to play in it, but I think there were clearly personal differences as well. And I think it was unforgivable that Evelyn Gleeson wasn't mentioned in that interview. There was sort of mediations and they tried various things, but in 1908, relationships completely broke down and Evelyn Gleeson was willing to forgo her investment in the Yeats side of the business, that's in the printing press and in the production of embroidery. So the Yeats sisters left and set up on their own on Churchtown Road. They took their areas of production, which were the private press printing and embroidery, with them. And Evelyn Gleeson continued in the tapestries and carpet making, and one of the conditions was that the Yeats would not use the Dúnemer name. And Dúnemer was very successful. It went on, it survived into the mid-1960s. It moved in 1912, it moved from Dundrum to Hardwick Street, But it got some very important commissions, international commissions. It made the Dáil carpets here. It survived and was quite successful.
So what's the relationship between Cúla and Dúnemer then? Is one the overall umbrella industry and Dúnemer being the press?
It was a complete split. So there were two separate companies. So you had the Dúnemer Guild, completely separate, run by Evan Leeson, and nothing whatsoever then to do with Cúla at that stage.
So it's the Eight Sisters now continue with Cúla.
It was Cúla Industries, and the Cúla Press was part of Cúla Industries. So there were other small things like painted woodwork in there, bookbinding, the embroidery, and then there was sort of the hand-produced, the hand-coloured prints that were disseminated worldwide.
Talk to me about Cúla Press then, because it continues to produce, in the words of the entry in the Dictionary of Irish Biography on Elizabeth, it says it continued to produce magnificent books. It talks about W.B. Yeats's The Green Helmet and other poems in 1910, a series of broadsides published between 1908 and 1915 with illustrations from Jack Yeats and so on. But then it also describes how there were tensions, there were strains in the family. John Butler Yeats had to reprimand William Butler Yeats for sending obnoxious letters to his sisters on the subject. There seems to be financial issues that caused huge stress and anxiety. So there were successes and achievements, but also problems and difficulties.
The war, well, definitely there were financial stresses, because there's a letter from Elizabeth Yeats 4 months before she died when she was in hospital saying she really needs to get out of here to deliver her art class because she's short on finances. So she should have been long retired at that stage. And there were stresses in the family. They were working together. And I think if people were to sort of even report on my own family, there'd be stresses. And I think there's stresses there in any family. I think what gets reported are the sort of the outbursts. But I think, as you mentioned earlier, what were a cohesive unit in another way and produced and worked to produce many books. Actually, there were 77 general books published and something around 40 private editions. So a very large output. And the other thing is private press. And there were many private arts and crafts private presses started in the early part of the 20th century. But Cúla's, I think, is the longest surviving, that it survived longer, you know. So its success is far outweighed anything else. And despite the tensions and that, it kept going.
What about politics when you had the War of Independence and the Civil War? What path did it take during that period?
Yeah, that's interesting, because it negotiated a path. You know, you had the Lord Lieutenant, the King's representative in Ireland at the time, was a sort of a customer of Cúla, and he would turn up and there would be security outside. And then there were two of the presswomen were arrested during the Civil War for having seditious material. And Cúla themselves, they published pamphlets and poetry for the Lord Lieutenant and others on the war. But then they also published Thomas MacDonagh's speech from the dock. And they published a memorial to Michael O'Callaghan, who was the Lord Mayor of Limerick, who was murdered in 1921. And the very last line on it says, "Murdered by the enemy." I have to say, all of these would have been beautifully published and would have been decorated initial letters and it would have been illustrated and it would have been published in limited numbers between 50 and 100. So they negotiated a path during the time of the Troubles. Just one other thing on the political thing as well. The government first art exhibition after independence that the government sponsored was held in Paris, and there was about 30 items from Cúla exhibited at that. The books were exhibited, the show, as the quote De Valera at the time said, "the genius in the race." And then there were many art prints displayed as well, because these were presenting an Irish identity for an international market. So you had Irish people who were presented as sort of handsome and hardworking, attached to the land, entitled to the land that they worked. You also had scenes by Jack Yeats of horse racing on the Strand, for example, a custom in Ireland to show that it was a vibrant, functioning state. And interestingly, after 1916 or 17, any of the prints they produced, the flags, the colours changed from green, white and gold. So the war very much politically engaged and aware and negotiated a difficult path through those turbulent times.
Susan, the Yeats International Summer School begins this Thursday, the 11th of July. It's running until the 19th of July. And you've always made sure that the sisters are part of the summer school, that they're remembered as part of Yeats Day. You used to run the Lily Lolly Craft Fest as part of that. And you have some of their work in the Yeats building. So you've seen it as very important to talk about their story and to share their story from the very beginning.
Yes, we always felt that somehow William and Jack were such great, large characters and had, if you like, Jack was even quite slow in finding his place. And Hilary Pyle, we owe a lot to her work in terms of placing Jack, you know, as a great Irish painter. And William, of course, had won the Nobel Prize in 1923, which, of course, contributed somewhat. He did find it in his heart to give some money to the Kula Press and to pay off their debts at that point, which was a huge relief to both Elizabeth and Susan. It was very important when I first got engaged with Yeats Day in 2012, when I first launched the idea of the birthday for William Butler Yeats, that the sisters be celebrated as well, because it was clear that their contribution was significant, but obviously in that way of that time, they had supported their brothers supported them in the business, but they were still often seen as just the kind of quiet sisters that hadn't really been able to break through and create their own space and their own place. And in fact, Nicola Gordon Bowe was one of the first people who came to Sligo, I think in 2013, to speak about the Yeats sisters and about the arts and crafts movement in Ireland. So we find too, with our global visitors into the Yeats building, they always love to hear about the sisters. They loved, we have one embroidery of Susan's, and they literally lean in and always their breath is taken away by just the exquisite working. We have some of Elizabeth's books on display. We talk about them as part of the family business, but also hugely importantly, of course, as part of the great contribution they made to an emerging Ireland at the beginning of the 20th century, when Willie was really busy and tied up at that point originally, trying to create and make the Abbey Theatre work, which of course that was going alongside the establishment of Dunemer in the same time frame. And he was doing his best to forge that, and then would also be trying to support the Dunemer enterprise at the beginning, which became, of course, as cool as the others have said. So we've always wanted them to be as important. And so, you know, our website says William Butler Yeats and the family. And it is about supporting this great talented family who were able to come together, who could work together, but then could fall explosively apart. For example, when W.B. Yeats wanted a Ezra Pound's book to be published by the Kula Press, and Elizabeth basically had a hissy fit and said, that's not within the realm of what we do here. This Ezra Pound is he's an outlier here. Why would we have him? And that led to huge argument between them, but William won that day. And so there were all sorts of, but that would be inevitable in a family like that anyway. Even if they weren't dragging some of their old, younger relationships, if you like, into that business, they were going to have arguments because of the great creative capacities they all had. And certainly during the summer school, in some years and not in others, you know, we always find some place to talk about the sisters and sometimes include them in they have their own lectures. To talk about the sisters. I mean, it's the longest running literary summer school in the world. It's 65 this year. And it's really lovely to be able to include all the family at the school. And, you know, it's a great achievement, I will say, for all those who went before over the years of creating a summer school. A bit of a, sometimes, a difficult task, a bit reflecting some of the difficulties perhaps that the Yeats family themselves had when they were building their own work up and, you know, trying to get an audience. And even getting on a boat and going all the way to America to sell their wares. I mean, they had courage. They had spirit. They weren't going to be stopped by small things like the distance across the Atlantic Ocean. So I do always take my hat off to them for being, as I say, brave, courageous and extraordinarily creative.
And it is an absolutely wonderful programme. I'm looking at it here. There's, as well as the poetry, there's film showings, there's mountain climbing, there's a Japanese print workshop. So it's continuing that exploration of watercolour painting and art making and that extraordinary contribution to the crafts as well. And Susan, I'm fascinated by what you said about the embroidery that Susan, that Lily did and how impressive that was, and there was that whole embroidery section as part of Kula, but then as Lily's health became too bad to continue in the 1930s, that whole wing seems to have stopped, and it doesn't seem that it was possible to create maybe a generation of people creating similar pieces.
Yes, and I mean, embroidery, when you think back of the places you've seen that beautiful intricate embroidery, it always comes from that time. I mean, we still, some of us will have grown up and remember the, in front of the fireplace, there'd always be a, you know, a, an embroidered piece in front of the fireplace and a wooden frame or something to keep the place looking pretty when the fire wasn't lit. A fire guard, in a sense. But that beautiful, intricate embroidery, such an expense, such a terrible length of time to create it. You can see how it was difficult for people to take over. Women were being educated now, weren't sitting at home embroidering in the manner they once did in the 19th century. And Susan's embroidery, the one we happen to have, is the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun, which, of course, are the closing lines of Yeats' famous poem, The Song of Wandering Aengus. And there's just something very, very beautiful about the colours, about the light in the colours, about the blues and the sort of shape. It's not too big, it's not too small. It seems almost to be a perfect piece. And I'm literally not exaggerating when I say that people lean in and go, wow, this is stunning. It's almost like they've never seen an embroidery like this before. And it always lifts my heart. I never get bored sharing that piece with people, because every time I look at it, I also think, how beautiful is that? And I have an image of Susan sitting, you know, in the room, carefully embroidering, surrounded by the women they were training to encourage embroidery to be, you know, to be shared and to the tradition to be kept on. And of course, I know there are now a whole new emergence of people doing embroidery, but it's a different kind of thing in a way. There was a mindfulness to it, of course, as well. And perhaps for Susan, sometimes that was a good thing to keep, you know, to keep that kind of calm in the space that that she had with the much more explosive and much more busy Elizabeth, that it was inevitable, really, that Susan would be the embroiderer, and that Elizabeth, while she learned the basics, really, she never took to it. It was too slow for her.
Roisin, it's fascinating to hear the description of these pieces. And what you can really see is that the Irish arts and crafts movement has its own distinct identity. And it appears that this is different from what's happening in Britain at the same time, and that there is something unique about what's happening here.
Yeah, I think there's certain crafts that Ireland excelled in that don't apply to Britain. One that doesn't relate to Dunemer is obviously stained glass, which, you know, Ireland excelled at. The embroidery, the rugs that Dunemer went on, as Billy has said, to produce in the post-independence period are all very distinctive aspects. But I think one of the major ones, as we've discussed, is that of book production. And those images as well, those little illustrated prints and cards that Dunemer and then Cooley produced, are very, very distinctive, I think, of the Irish arts and crafts movement, and represent a kind of, in many ways, an idealised view of both Irish urban, but particularly Irish rural life. You know, in thinking about the difference between the arts and crafts movement between Ireland and Britain, and their massive differences. I mean, obviously in Ireland, for most of Ireland, we didn't experience the Industrial Revolution on the same scale. So the goals of the arts and crafts movement were very different, I think, in Ireland, and very closely linked with the cultural revival and with a search for national identity. But in thinking about the Yeats sisters, I think one of the most important features is that women were very, very prominent in the arts and crafts movement in Ireland at all levels, starting off as the kind of the benefactors, the aristocratic benefactors in the 1880s, to the women that were working in Dunemer and Cooley that were being trained as embroiderers or print workers. And I think that might be part of the reason for the revival of interest in those movements now, with the rise of sort of feminism. We're able to re-examine, particularly, I think, on Tor Glynna, the Stained Glass Cooperative, and Dunemer and Cooley, because Dunemer and Cooley, despite the interventions, if you like, of W.B. Yeats and Jack Yeats, were primarily female-run businesses from top to bottom, if you like.
And you're speaking at the Yeats Sisters Symposium this Saturday, and you're talking about that contribution to the arts and crafts movement. And do you think that the work of the Yeats Sisters made a significant contribution to the visual culture of 20th century Ireland?
I think it did, yes. I think, well, first of all, the productions of those books were revived by Lee Miller in the late 1960s, 1970s. And they've become a very, very distinctive part of Irish graphic art, graphic design. And also, I think those little prints, those images, they were reproduced, or versions of them were produced by other companies that were set up in the 1920s and 1930s. So from that point of view, yes, I think they did make a major contribution to Irish visual culture in the 20th century.
Well, tonight we are talking about the contribution of the Yeats sisters to the Irish cultural revival and indeed to Irish heritage. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be teasing out the legacy of the sisters. Welcome back. We're talking history. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel as we explore the life and legacy of the Yeats sisters, Dr. Roisin Kennedy of UCD, Dr. Quailene Ní Bhacón of the University of Limerick, Susan O'Keefe, the director of Yeats Society Sligo, and Dr. Billy Shortle of Trinity College Dublin. Billy, tell us about the exhibition that's taking place in the Old Library in Trinity, because co-created by Dr. Angela Griffith, I think DFA, the Department of Foreign Affairs, are involved as well, yes, and Angela Byrne. And it's a very interesting look at the collections and the lives of these extraordinary women.
Yes, it's a focused, themed exhibition, and it looks at sort of the making, female entrepreneurship involved. And in the cabinets, there are examples of obviously the books to produce, many of the prints, but some of the original artwork that would lead to the prints. Also, there's embroidery and some embroidery designs as well. And there's a number of digital displays with sort of more images. And it gives a view of Coola's output over the years and what they were about, really.
And what would you see as their legacy?
Their legacy is really as an arts and crafts enterprise. You have to remember, Coola started in 1902 and produced their last book, and there were no prints designed after 1946. And Elizabeth had died in 1940. And management was taken over by George Yeats, William Butler Yeats's wife, and she kept it going until 1968, just producing the prints and Christmas cards up until 1968. And then in 1969, it was revived again, as Roisin has said, by Lee Miller, along with Anne Yeats and Michael Yeats, and it kept going to the 1980s. So it had that endurance. But the legacy, the output, the books as art objects, the contents of the books of important writers of the Irish literary revival, and they've been listed, like Synge, Lady Gregory, Catherine, and particularly William Butler Yeats. He was their most prolific author. So that's a wonderful literary legacy. And then in the art prints, there are images of Irish life, idealised images of Irish life in some cases, but it gives a view of this identity that Ireland was seeking, and they dovetailed very much with sort of political aspirations during their life as well. Like, this is the Ireland that we wanted, how we saw ourselves. And then it sort of the embroideries that someone mentioned are just exquisite. They're beautiful, beautiful artworks. And there's a very nice one on display in the Trinity exhibition.
And that's going to be running for 3 months, I think.
About 3 months. Yes.
Very good. Okay. And Quailene, you're also speaking at the symposium on Saturday, and you're talking about the Dunemer Press and the contribution of Elizabeth to that and the transatlantic connections. And I'm interested in that in terms of the legacy, the way it wasn't just a major contribution in terms of the Irish revival and Irish culture and heritage, but also these international connections.
That's right, Patrick. And I think there's a few aspects to this. One, you know, how we saw ourselves, but also I think how others saw us. You know, I think it was very much part of what we would now term proto-diplomacy, you know, before the state, you know, this sense that creating an international identity for Ireland that was distinctive, And that had influence, and that changed people's perceptions. I mean, a very good example of this is someone like Theodore Roosevelt, who in the late 19th century had quite negative, you know, made very negative statements about Ireland. But in 1908, is kind of drawing on the Irish cooperative movement, is meeting, you know, luminaries of the revival, and is, you know, arguing for it to have chairs in Celtic studies and Irish studies in leading American universities. So I think that's one aspect. I think also, you know, the creation of a visual language that becomes synonymous with Ireland, not just the distinctive design, but also even down to the press mark, you know, and it was one of the things that was William Butler Yeats asked Eleanor Monsell to design the press mark for the press. And she had also did the logo of Queen Maeve and the Wolfhound for our famous, the famous logo for the Abbey Theatre. And in a sense, what we see here is this kind of very distinctive visual language that becomes synonymous and goes on into the new state. And, you know, you mentioned earlier about, you know, when the break comes with between Dunema and Kula. But, you know, they for the, I think, about 11 volumes afterwards, they still use the Dunema press mark, but without the Dunema name. And so there is that kind of continuity there. So I think there's some, I think as well, there's two other things. One is the kind of the fact that they wanted to have an Irish female workforce, that it was very much that kind of enterprise. And you mentioned, you know, why wasn't there this, you know, I suppose the embroidery, you know, dies out in a sense. But in a way, what they did with these Irish workers is they had intended, or they had wanted, that they would become, as Evelyn Gleeson said in that first perspective, teachers to others, so that similar industries may spread throughout the land. There was a real ambition. And again, it ties in with some of the other movements at the time, like around the Irish Cooperative Society, that you would have women preparing them for a future that did not yet exist, a kind of utopian future where women would have these opportunities. So I think in very quiet ways, and again, one of the things that has always been noted about both Evelyn Gleeson and the Eight Sisters is that their employees were remarkably loyal to them. You know, they stayed with them, you know, often they started at 14 or 15 and they spent, you know, decades of their lives working with them. So in that sense, I think as well, how they created influential women with expectations. A lot of those women went on to become writers or artists or Abbey actresses. And I think, yeah, so I think in all sorts of domains, they had the legacy lived on.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to Dr. Roisin Kennedy of UCD, Dr. Quailín Ivacón of the University of Limerick, Susan O'Keefe, the director of Yeats Society Sligo, and Dr. Billy Shortle of Trinity College Dublin. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Hannah Flam on research. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so I hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.